We'll start the meeting of the Watershed, Wetlands, and Buffers Subcommittee. We don't have quorum yet, but I do intend to, when quorum is present, I will know it, and then we will approve the minutes. We do have some members that are in other committees, and we have a lot of folks that have testified today, but we're going to start off with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And Mr. Thomas, while you're coming up, I believe last night a supplemental budget came out, and there's an item in there related to Bowser, if you can maybe note that as well as you go through the project.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. And Mr. Chair, you're correct. A supplemental budget was released by Commissioner Tom Hansen yesterday that went to the leadership of the House and Senate, and it did include a bonding recommendation of $10 million to the board, basically for leveraging WRP, Federal Government Wetland Reserve Program, and to continue the state's obligations to meet the landowner requests that come in under the CREP 2 program. So there is $10 million there. We'd already talked about RIM previously, so I thought I would mention that now so that that is on the record. We left off on page 22 of the PowerPoint presentation. I'd like to pick up there. What I'd like to do is go through the next few programs fairly quickly so we can focus most of our time today on the 08 budget and the change items that we have under consideration by the committee. On Wetland Conservation Act, I just want to basically reference this was enacted in 1991, at which time basically wetland protection was expanded to all wetlands in the state of Minnesota. Prior to that, wetland protection was only extended to what was considered the DNR public waters wetlands, type 3, 4s, and 5s, greater than 2.5 acres in a municipality, and greater than 10 acres in greater Minnesota. Basically, just want to point out that the Wetland Conservation Act is rather unique in that it's implemented by 340 local units of government, oversight by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, where we get involved in appeals and enforcement actions and training and administration of grants to local governments, and then enforced by the DNR through the DNR conservation officers. Moving on, we've got two other main kind of areas under what we call technical services. First one is the State Soils Office. That's a program that we do in partnership with the University of Minnesota. It's really designed to increase the usefulness of the current comprehensive or modern soil survey data that we have in the state, update outdated surveys, and then to start providing ways to look at how we digitize current soil surveys so we can get to the point in time soon where we have digitized soil survey coverage statewide. And then we have an engineering and technical services section, which provides, we provide engineers and skilled technicians to assist in the design of the large and most complex wetland restoration projects, provide some specialized service in lake and coastal engineering, shoreline stabilization, and then lastly, participate with the USDA NRCS in the development of standards for soil conservation practices from time to time. The last program area on slide 24 is the Clean Water Legacy Act. Again, that was new for us starting in fiscal year 07 with the Clean Water Legacy Act passing last year. Really created a major policy framework and directed Bowser along with the Department of Ag as basically the lead agencies for non-point pollution reduction efforts. PCA primarily responsible for assessment and monitoring and TMDL development. Bowser and the Department of Ag focusing on the non-point source restoration protection activities that are laid out in the Act, and then the PCA and the Public Facilities Authority primarily responsible for the point source side of it, the wastewater treatment facilities and the point source discharges. Basically, the Act talks about restoring waters that are impaired, cleaning, keeping waters that are clean clean, using existing programs, providing new money, and then requiring interagency cooperation. On slide 25, again, I'm not going to spend any time on this, but again, it's that conceptual model for you of how those grant dollars that are given to Bowser that go out to support non-point restoration and protection activities are done through kind of formal agreements and what some of those what some of the requirements of the grant recipients are and what are the results and outcomes that are expected of those grants. Moving on to slide 26, just to highlight a little bit of the 07 activities of the money that we did receive. For the first time ever, we had a joint agency request for proposal, which I think was a real highlight for us. That was out in August of 2006. We received 181 requests or proposals requesting just a little over $44 million. We were able to fund 51 projects for just a little over $8 million, and that $8 million was money that was provided by the legislature to both the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the DNR, the Department of Ag through their Ag BMP loan program, and PCA bringing some federal Section 319 money. So we lumped that together, coordinated our efforts, and went through that process. 67% of the funds went to restoration projects in 12 watersheds with TMDL-approved plans. And I think it's an important point. Restoration dollars follow the approval of TMDL implementation plans. To date, there are 12 in the state that are completed. By the end of this year, we expect approximately 27 TMDLs to be completed and to have approved implementation plans. And then PCA, in their 08-09 budget request, at $9 million a year for TMDL development, anticipate 20 per year being completed and having approved. So you can kind of sense that there is a ramp-up of implementation. It doesn't all happen in the first year. And then we were able to leverage just under $7 million of local government and landowner funds. The next page on 27 just simply shows you kind of geographically where those dollars went. The shaded areas on the left are those areas with the 12 TMD or where those 12 TMDL plans, the area that they make up. And on the right, those were the counties that received funding, or funding went into those counties to support protection efforts. And protection efforts are tied to high-priority water resource activities that are identified in a comprehensive local water management plan. So we tie it back to that local water planning program that we spoke about at the last meeting. On slide 28, just to touch on in terms of what some of the water quality indicators that we're going to be looking at, clearly from a non-point perspective, the two primary pollutants of concern are sediment and phosphorus, which are the two primary pollutants that we see most of the TMDLs relating to, in addition to bacteria is also one. And I just point out on the bottom there, that chart is an example. The Redwood River watershed in southwestern Minnesota has had an ongoing implementation effort now for approximately 10 years. And that started with a Clean Water Partnership, extended to some challenge grants, some money that came through the Minnesota River Joint Powers Board. And you can see what it shows there is that trend line of, in terms of the total suspended solids, the amount of loading that was in the river is going down. And so there is a positive trend line that relates directly to those implementation activities. So we're in the future, we hope to be able to continue to show project by project those kind of trend lines. With that, I'd like to switch over to the 08-09 budget. The 08-09 budget, recommended budget for the Board of Water and Soil Resources is roughly $48 million. A little over $45 million comes from general fund appropriations, $2.876 million from the LCCMR, and that's for local water planning challenge grants, some projects that are related to the soil survey update and providing web-based tools for distributing soil survey information. And then we have a co-op project with the USGS on the Minnesota River where we're involved in the evaluation of CREP and land set-aside programs on both water quality and biological integrity of streams in southern Minnesota and the relationship of those programs, the implementation of programs to that. And then on the special revenues, $100,000, and that's a very small amount of the budget. It's primarily made up of fees that we receive when we get an appeal under the Wetland Conservation Act, as well as wetland banking transactions. Anytime that a landowner deposits credits or withdraws credits, there's a transaction fee for that, and that makes up that $100,000.
Mr. Thomas, how many FTEs do you have in FY07, and how many in the proposed budget?
Mr. Chair,
is that coming up somewhere?
I'm not sure that it comes up specifically. I'm going to go back just a second. Give me a moment here. If you go back to slide 7, we currently have 48 FTEs that are paid through the general fund, and with the change items that we're talking about in this budget, there will be an increase of approximately 12 to 13 FTE, depending on if we hire those or we actually maybe enter into some contract for services or collaborate with, for example, the University of Minnesota or somebody else on some implementation activities. Just one other point that was made earlier in the year is, in case the question does come up, over the last two bienniums, the board has gone through an 11% reduction in general fund expenditures. The percent increase from 06-07 to 08-09 is 24% increase in general fund revenues to the board. The next thing I'd like to do is run through just a couple of quick slides for you in terms of the breakdown of that revenue. Graphically, you can see that roughly 94% or $45 million of the board's budget is general fund, which we don't have a lot of fees and we don't have a lot of other revenue capability, as you might see in some of the other agencies that have presented information to the committee. Moving on to slide 31, as we look at revenue by category, 24.2% is supports agency operations, and 75.8% goes directly out to local governments in the form of grants. As we look on page 32 to the expenditure side, you can see how the general operating budget is broken out. Again,
Representative Hoppe.
Quick question, and I should know this, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. Is there anything in statute that says who the grants have to go to in terms of what forms of local governments can receive the money?
Mr. Chair, if you just a moment, I think on slide 33 we'll talk about the breakdown of that grant expenditures.
It's unusual for me to think ahead. So. Thank you.
Basically, just ending on slide 32, the largest share of the operation budget is for salary and benefits, and then you can see the other small breakdowns, things like information technology, professional technical services, which support contracts that we have to support some of the e-link program that we have and some of the maintenance of that software and development costs relating to that software. So you get a sense of how those are broken out. Moving on to slide 33 is a breakdown of those grant funds, and these are, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, the areas where we are statutorily required to provide grant funds to. Clean Water Legacy in 07, you can see, was $9.7 million for the 08-09 biennium based on the governor's recommended budget, or roughly 20%. That money is available to organizations that have approved local water management plans and have an approved TMDL plan. So those could be counties, watershed districts, or soil water districts, either individually or working through a formal joint powers agreement or some form of a watershed organization. And there's many different ways in which that happens around the state. The next one is the state cost share program, and those are grants to soil and water districts for landowner contracts for either erosion and water quality projects or feedlot water quality management projects. SWCD general service grants, $7.1 million. That is the money that goes to SWCDs to support kind of the base operations to make sure they have the technical capacity out there and the ability to work day in and day out with private landowners, and that's the state's general support for those organizations. The Natural Resources Block Grant, $8.2 million, those are grants that go to counties to support for Bowser, the state's Wetland Conservation Act responsibilities, as well as to support the implementation of comprehensive local water management plans. And then you can see there's some additional activities under drainage, the LCCMR, and a very small percentage of other grants, which are things like Study Area 2, which receives $104,000 in this budget, as well as the Red River Basin Commission, which receives some money through the Bowser budget to support their efforts in the Red River Valley. Moving on to the budget change items, we have four change items this year relating to compensation and inflation, the Wetland Conservation Act, drainage, and clean water legacy. The first change item, compensation inflation on 35, represents a 2% increase for employee compensation, and that's what's built into the governor's budget for all agencies, as well as a $50,000 increase to the agency for rent. And somebody asked previously, well, what was that, why $50,000 now? 2 years ago, the agency moved from 1 West Water Street in a private building south of the river into the DNR PCA complex, and we negotiated a 10-year lease with the Pollution Control Agency, and they were very generous in basically waiving our rent for the first 2 years, recognizing the budget situation that we were in, as well as the value of having the agency located with DNR and PCA in the complex over on Lafayette. We now have to start paying that.
Representative Hoppe.
You certainly don't have to answer this, but I'm just curious. Is the move working out? Do you like being with DNR and PCA?
Mr. Thomas.
Yeah. Really, you don't have to answer. I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, I'd be happy to answer that. Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I think the move has been very useful. For one thing, being there and not having to drive back and forth across the river, there's a lot more informal communication that takes place, not only with our professional staff, but also our ability, both our executive director and assistance directors, to just pick up the phone and say, can we meet for a cup of coffee, for example, and talk about issues that were related. So I think we actually are seeing better coordination and more discussion on a lot of the program levels because it's much easier to have that communication when you're in close proximity rather than having to get in the car and drive across the river.
Let's get MnDOT in there, too. It's a joke.
Actually, we'll be out of space in the building.
Well, you know.
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, moving on to slide 36 under the Wetland Conservation Act. The change items that you have in front of you in our budget are an outgrowth of a number of different things. First is a Wetland Conservation Act assessment, which was requested by the administration in 2005. That work has been completed. There is an agency policy bill that has now finally gotten the approvals that we needed through the Clean Water Cabinet and the Governor's Office, and that's being jacketed and introduced. I believe Representative Hansen is carrying that bill on the House side. It also, the change item recognizes a number of documented workload increases, particularly in the areas of appeals and enforcements. Also a recognition that we need to, as a state, we have an obligation to monitor and to enforce the wetlands that are restored and created for purposes of the State Wetland Day, as well as our responsibility to restore wetlands for road safety improvement projects, which is a statutory responsibility that we have. And then it also recognizes the need that we talked about a lot this last year, is the need for a more coordinated restoration strategy, looking at how the federal, state, and private programs that operate in Minnesota can work together and be more strategically aligned and get more benefit for all of the programs together. Slide 37 that you have is just two different graphs that show you graphically the wetland appeals, the increasing trend, and then also the enforcement trends, the number of cease and desist orders and the number of restoration orders that are written. For every increase in the enforcement that's done by DNR, the flyovers that were done this past year, they create work at the local level. They create work for the local governments that have to go out and look at every one of those potential violations, determine whether or not they qualify for an exemption, all of those kinds of things, as well as additional work for our staff, because then many times those decisions either were involved directly in them or they may be appealed back to Bowser. So it just gives you kind of a graphical representation of some of that increasing workload that we've seen over the years. On slide 38, really talks about the change items that are specifically related to our budget. $500,000 annually to offset the costs of violations, monitoring, and enforcement by local government. We're looking at roughly $400,000 of that will be made available on a challenge basis to those local governments which have some of the highest enforcement and monitoring workload in the state. Typically, if you were to think of the state and drew a line from Rochester to the Twin Cities to Alexandria, from that line north is where we see the greatest amount of activity taking place. We're looking at using a...
Just a second, Mr. Thomas. So we're, with the budget request, we're asking for a $500,000 to pay for the cost of enforcing the law. When you find more violations, you got to have more money to do that. There's not a cost recovery mechanism like there are under some other environmental laws for the violator to pay for the violation.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Basically, at the time when somebody comes in, the local government may have an application fee or like a permit fee, but once that's done and it moves into an enforcement situation, there is no cost recovery. That's a cost that's borne by the DNR, Bowser, and those local governments, as well as an expectation for increased monitoring of activities out there on a more regular basis. Again, there is no way to recover costs for a stepped-up monitoring effort out, in counties or out on the land as well.
But there are other statutes, other pieces of environmental law where there is cost recovery for violations, I believe, and for environmental damages. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that may be correct, for particularly with the Pollution Control Agency, where they uncover and find violations. They have the ability to have administrative penalty orders and to fine or charge somebody for the time or for the effort that it takes to resolve that violation, and also potentially some mitigation of that as well. That's not an authority that we've been extended, and we have not sought that kind of authority. It's very controversial.
So I'm clear, Bowser does not have administrative penalty authority.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Of that $500,000 at the local government level of funding, we're also looking at roughly a split, again, of $400,000 that would be made available kind of in a challenge basis, and roughly $100,000 that we would look at trying to work and coordinate more closely with the DNR in terms of kind of how their flyover program is designed and works and gets implemented in a more systematic way, rather than kind of how it's happened to date, where it's just, all of a sudden the message comes out, we're going to fly in 14 counties. We think there needs to be a much more systematic approach. We want to be able to work closely with them, and when those flyovers do take place, being able to help support that increased local government workload out there, because obviously that generates a huge kind of one-time cost that can involve county attorney time as well as local staff time, as well as the DNR conservation officers on the ground as a result of that. There's $60,000 in the budget, which is a one-time expenditure in FY08 for a comprehensive plan. That's the restoration plan strategy that we talked about, and we're doing that right now primarily through a contract with for staff person at the DNR who's helping oversee that for us. It's actually a collaborative effort between all of the agencies to develop this comprehensive wetland restoration strategy, and that's money to support that. We hope to have that work done within a year. $60,000 annually to Bowser to monitor and enforce wetland replacement and bank sites. That's that statutory responsibility that I mentioned that we had. And in this particular case, that will leverage approximately $60,000 of federal funds through the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, as they have a similar requirement to monitor many of the restoration sites that they're doing. We found it's a very good collaborative effort, so that we're using kind of the same standards, the same field protocol. And actually, when we have staff out in the field, guess what? They're maybe within a mile or two, oftentimes, of those same federal projects, and so they're helping us do some of the work that they need to do themselves. And then $500,000 annually to Bowser, that's to support state staff for technical support to local units of government, the increase in appeal workload that I talked about before that's out there, and then, again, statute and rule changes that are going to come through the policy bill that we've introduced that kind of parallels with this. Just to touch a little bit on what are some of the outcomes of this new expenditure of funds for Bowser. One is improved data. We certainly saw through the wetland assessment that we don't have all of the data or the right data that we need to make or answer some of the questions about how effective is the program operating out there in terms of actual no net loss of wetlands on the regulatory side. So this will help us improve our data. It'll provide the the policy piece is going to provide for a modest reduction in the loss of wetlands under the regulatory program. That comes through some changes to the exemptions, some changes to the de minimis, which is basically an amount of square feet that anybody can have. And then the replacement ratios that are required when somebody does fill or drain a wetland and has to mitigate that wetland. There's a set of replacement ratios, and those are going to be changed, and some of those ratios will be going up. All of those three things combined will result in moving closer to no net loss on the regulatory side, but won't take us to zero. And then also to help us continue to improve the administrative efficiency and the regulatory simplification. And that really comes through by our work with the Corps of Engineers. Virtually every wetland in the state, not only is it under WACA jurisdiction, but it's either under the jurisdiction of the USDA NRCS through a program called Swamp Buster or the Corps of Engineers through their 404 permit program. One of our goals is to really, from a landowner perspective, minimize the duplication of effort, so when they come in, it's more or less one-stop shopping for that landowner so that they're getting all of those parts dealt with rather than having to, you know, basically be told, no, we're only going to deal with this. You go deal with the Corps, and you go deal with somebody else. And so it will help us continue to move in that move towards some of that efficiency and simplification. Moving on to slide 40, our next change item results to drainage. And this goes back for us to 2000, again into 2005, when we were directed by the legislature to conduct a public drainage ditch buffer study. That study was completed in 2006. A work group that was put together to complete that study continued to work for a year and developed a number of consensus recommendations that looked at how to enhance and improve the establishment of buffers, but also, actually let me move to 41 and I'll cover what those quickly what those work group recommendations were. The work group recommended that there's a great need in the state of Minnesota to preserve and modernize public drainage record system or records out there. We found a number of areas where they identified the need to enhance the authorities of public drainage authorities to implement ditch buffers. There were some impediments that we found to that, as well as some issues in terms of certain types of proceedings and the cost of those proceedings. And there's a policy bill, as it mentions on the bottom, House File 577, which is carrying the policy elements of changing 103, the state's ditch law. They also identified the need for annual reporting, updating the state's public drainage manual, and establishing a drainage assistance team. And I think that team concept is very critical to being able to provide the kind of that technical assistance to drainage authorities as they're contemplating projects, to make sure that they're being able to look at some of those environmental options, some of those water management system options that we have. I won't go over those, but there is some information in the three-ring binder that you have. There's a case study from Nicollet County where we were able to work and provide that technical assistance, help them figure out all of the different funding players that are out there. And they actually, we were able to restore some wetlands on a county tile line or county tile system, resulting in major reductions in nitrate and, to a degree, phosphorus runoff from that particular watershed. The fiscal items in that change item are on 42, $300,000 per year to establish a drainage assistance team, $150,000, which would be one time in fiscal year 08, and that would be to prepare guidelines for drainage records preservation and modernization, and then $500,000 in one-time funding in fiscal year 09 to accelerate cost share for drainage records preservation and modernization with our public drainage authorities, and that would be a one-to-one cost share arrangement with them. Moving on to page 43, talk a little bit about what some of the outcomes are that we expect if that change item is funded. 75% or more drainage authorities having that will have implemented records modernization within 5 years. We think that's a very reasonable expectation. The drainage manual will be updated in 2 years. The guidelines will be prepared in 1 year. The two key ones is really a goal of all of this is to increase the number of miles of ditch buffers by removing some of the impediments that we identified, as well as providing some enhanced authorities, which occurs through the policy language, as well as in the drainage assistance team being able to work with county drainage authorities and watershed district when they're acting as drainage authorities, to really figure out ways in which we can capitalize on some of the federal programs. Things like continuous sign-up CRP is a very good example in trying to help promote buffer strips. As well, I think that TMDL efforts in some parts of the state will also point a finger at the public drainage systems and also will help promote increasing the amount of miles of ditches that are buffered. And then lastly, improving the enforcement of buffer violations. That was one of the things that we found in the study is that that's inconsistent around the state, and one of the goals is to improve the enforcement of those buffers where they're required and they're found not to be in place. Moving on to the slide 44, next change item deals with clean water legacy. Again, FY07 was one-time funding, so this is the governor's recommendation for Bowser for the 08-09 biennium. Just the total governor's package was $40 million in general fund to Bowser, DNR, Department of Ag, PCA, and PFA are the players. For Bowser specifically, it's $5.45 million per year. And that's broken out into the following categories. The top two are really the non-point restoration activities that are going to be funded. $1.5 million per year for cost share and incentive payments as the watershed projects or the local governments work with landowners to make those corrective actions, particularly for those agricultural, rural, and urban non-point sources of pollution. And then $2 million a year to support that work with technical assistance and engineering assistance. In addition, being proposed at $2 million per year. So roughly $3.5 million going into restoration activities. $200,000 a year to the board for reporting and evaluation. You've seen some of the results of our e-link reporting system. We need to continue to improve and enhance that, particularly as we look at tying that to the outcomes that are expected with the Clean Water Legacy Act, as well as then the ability to help evaluate that information and provide that information back to the decision makers on it. $750,000 per year for the county ISTS programs. There was a fair amount of discussion about that at the last meeting, and this is money because of our delivery system of being able to have grants with every county in the state. That is money that comes through us, again, to point out that the state's ISTS regulation is done by PCA, and obviously we continue to work closely with them, particularly now that the funding has gone up. Prior to last year, counties received on average $800 per year in funding to support their ISTS programming. Last year, with the increase through Clean Water Legacy for ISTS, that went up to about $7,000 per year. So now that the funding's increased, I think it's reasonable to expect that the kind of reporting and the kind of information that the state expects to get back will be changing as well. And then there's $1 million for protection activities. And those are activities that are geared, of course, to not addressing waters that are impaired, but addressing waters, river streams, and lakes that are not impaired but may show a trend where their water quality is decreasing, and you want to stop that trend before it gets into the point where it becomes impaired and we're back into that very regimented and very costly TMDL process. In this whole package, there will be approximately 5 FTEs for Bowser that will be funded as part of this change item initiative.
Mr. Thomas, those 5 are part of the 12 to 13 that you mentioned previously?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There would be under the clean water, under the drainage change item, there's money for 3 staff there, roughly 5 under Clean Water Legacy, and 6 under the Wetland Conservation Act change items. That's how we come up with that 12 to 13 number for you.
And Mr. Thomas, how many FTEs have you lost since 2003?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to remember 11 FTE, Mr. Chair.
So this will bring you about to where you were a little less than...
Mr. Chair, in terms of total numbers of staff, that's correct. There are some functional areas, obviously, that we have reduced staffing in over the last, you know, 2 biennium that aren't necessarily replaced in terms of these particular change items. So numbers are similar. Categories are different. Moving on to slide 45, some of the key measures that we have under Clean Water Legacy is a continued commitment to coordinate our funding decisions with the other agencies, creating a single point of entry for folks that are going to be engaged in implementing TMDL plans. With long-term funding, we really want one of our goals, and I think one of the key measures, is to finally be able to provide some multi-year commitments to these projects. You don't correct these TMDL watershed project areas in 1, 2 years. It's going to take 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And so as we look at this, one of our challenges is going to be, how do we look at in try to develop some long-term commitments, particularly where people are engaged in hiring additional technical staff, whether it's engineers, technicians, water quality specialists, lakeshore specialists, for example. They're going to be providing that technical assistance to landowners over a long period of time. We're going to continue to strive for a 70-30 split between funding between restoration and protection. We're going to utilize our current E-Link grant and reporting system to continue to capture the measures that we talked about in terms of reductions in sediment, nutrients, and other pollutants out there on these projects that are funded. Continue to summarize measurable pollutant load allocations by TMDL watersheds and project areas. And that's a key point is that we get the question sometimes about what will that $3.5 million buy, for example. It's difficult at the beginning of a process to say exactly what it's going to buy because that's not what drives the grant program. What drives the implementation is that local implementation plan. Those TMDL plans, for example, if it's a bacteria TMDL in southeast Minnesota, that TMDL plan allocates that load to various sectors. It'll allocate a percent of how much they have to reduce bacteria to get to the point where they are now within water quality standards. They'll allocate that to sectors like agriculture, ISTS, municipal wastewater, and then it's at that point in time that that allocation is made that we work with those partners to develop implementation plans, which then start stating specific measurable goals for how many ISTS systems are they going to upgrade, how many feedlots are they going to upgrade, how many pasture management plans, how many cattle exclusion projects are they going to do. And it's at that point then that we can begin to measure those, bring that information back, you know, in subsequent years to show the progress that's being made on these particular projects. The other thing with long-term funding, we're going to be able to start implementing and requiring effectiveness monitoring. And when we say effectiveness monitoring, that's actually beginning to measure what's in the lake or in the river and being able to compare that to the land treatment efforts that are taking place. We've also been told by many of the scientists that it can take 3, 4, 5 years before the water quality actually starts changing from a physical parameter, but there's a whole bunch of other things that are happening in terms of tracking land use, the acres that are adequately protected from erosion control, the number of miles of bank erosion that have been fixed, and things like that. And so that's where we need to have a combination of both the reporting that we do in E-Link as well as then looking at developing good, high-quality effectiveness monitoring programs in each one of those impaired areas. And then hopefully, you know, if we're able to be aggressive to start beginning to see waters removed from that 303D list, which is the impaired waters list, beginning in 5 years. And that's the goal of this whole thing, is to get those waters that are impaired cleaned up and off of that impaired waters list. And, Mr. Chair, that takes us to slide 46, which is our concluding slide for the committee, and basically just, again, emphasize the public benefits of private lands conservation. Most of what we do is related to clean air, clean water, and abundant fish and wildlife habitat. And just to recap, that the governor's recommendation for Bowser in 08-09 is $45.097 million. With that, happy to answer and respond to any questions that you may have.
Any questions from members? Representative Hoppe.
One quick one. You mentioned the case study for the Nicollet. Oh, never mind. I just found it.
Find it?
Okay. Else, I think. Yep. Easy question.
Representative Peterson? Or were you just itching? Mr. Thomas, I had a question that's on something a little different. I've had a number of advocate groups come talking to me about invasive species and wanting money to go to local units of government or to go to private lands for invasive species control. Some have said put it to the Department of Agriculture to create a program, or some to the Department of Natural Resources. It appears in your testimony you have a delivery mechanism out to local units of government. So my question is, has there been any discussion about delivering invasive species control grants to local units of government through the Board of Water and Soil Resources?
Mr. Chairman, there has not. We haven't had any really what I would call a direct conversation. I think when we think about invasives, we have to break them into aquatic and terrestrial, basically those things that are in the water versus those things that are on the land. Clearly, DNR would have the primary jurisdiction when you look at invasive species, particularly on the aquatic side, as well as many of the terrestrial sides, along with the Department of Ag. I believe there are some bills that are looking at some funding to the DNR this year to increase some of their efforts in invasive species. But when it comes to the terrestrial side, you pose a very interesting question, and I think there is opportunity in terms of looking at the delivery system that the board has. We do have a what's called a Conservation Innovation Grant right now with the U.S. Department of Agriculture looking at invasive species control for restored wetlands, recognizing that many of the wetland areas that we have are oftentimes dominated by reed canary grass, which is not probably the best vegetation to have there. The USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service does have some cost share available, and so our role, if we were to look at it, if we can tie together things like our state cost share, some of the technical assistance that's coming out of and the information coming out of like that Conservation Innovation Grant, and then making sure of how we partner with the federal government out there in those field offices, there certainly may be some opportunity to look at parts of that invasive picture.
Mr. Thomas, you have the experience in setting money. It just seems that if this is looking at private lands efforts with local government connection, that you guys have an existing delivery mechanism that, you know, we'll be talking in the next few days about accountability, well, maybe in the next few minutes about accountability with that system, but it's some concern that we have other agencies, you know, everybody has different pieces of the invasive species control effort, but it might be an opportunity there, and I would maybe encourage some discussions with DNR about that. I think what we're going to do, we do have other members that are in the building that we're going to try to get here, so I'm going to take a recess until 5 to 10. So we'll reconvene at 5 to 10. It is now 9:45, and I know we have a number of public testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Thomas, for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So recess until 5 to 10. Looking for the bill?
Yeah.
It's your bill.
Yeah. I won't ask anymore. I didn't see one.
Going to McDonald's?
I'm going to McDonald's.
I got cold.
Okay. You're in good cheer.
I brought you some, but then I drank it. Sorry. I had the best of intentions. I used to have a very weak.
No self-discipline.
The actual budget.
I think it's going to be too muddy to ski down that road.
Not the actual budget.
Where's them over there?
Oh, yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Because you can ski right down the middle of it.
Oh.
Out on the lake.
Said they couldn't do it.
State land. You get out there and you wonder why you do this. I could just be out here.
What happened to the general public?
Yeah.
Anyway. Gotta do it.
I think.
Why do we need this?
It was when I came in.
He ran all the I'll get it through our research.
They should not.
I'm just curious. So I know that this is room and perhaps we know and it's going okay. Well, I'm just wondering, do you know what the period of time for the crash was on the weapon restoration? It is perpetual for sure.
Okay.
The only thing that isn't under crap is for buffers of limited duration. So when we say crap and rim, we use a combination of Midwest Eastern crap to follow their already parcels that are on this project.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't remember. I
thought
that was the case.
No, it's not. See,
when I started with these shaded areas, and these also areas that are low enough.
Wasn't there a general fund portion of that?
Very likely, yes.
Water problem, we work one, type two, maybe type three wetlands. But for here, we have
fairly wet area.
This,
it could be clouds where I suspect what it is. It's some depressional or barrier.
I can't wait on that.
Poorly drained soil. Our benefit.
See you later.
We don't have to do much on the statutory stuff.
Into the county. So here's my last question. You can see this.
That's actually an outlet
right there. What we had to do is we had to get grade to so that we didn't
that too.
Damage the. So that's drainage running into here. So what happened was is because
17.
To get
to make this all
drain perspective, you don't want to flood. So we just have to build this channel from here back.
And they don't
say here.
What I was wondering is, is there any way that we can use these parts or whatever in there? And I assume this has got to be shallow enough when it's done so that it's going to freeze out.
If you're
what we're trying to do
on
all of our respiration,
this is the account.
Put some kind of
water.
Okay. That's what you've got here. This has got actually settled apples in it that went up and down the middle. You literally can go out there and pull them all up.
It's become
But you know what? But that's why I think some of the older restorations that were done used fixed kind of outlets. You know, you're limited on what you can do. We're trying to really, move away from that component of this kind of technology.
Well, so this
I didn't know what this was. I assumed, you know, where it went. I didn't know exactly what it worked out. But like what we were pointing out in terms of the drainage assistance.
But, to the natural resources.
You know, in this situation, we're watching the EMRH.
I guess
working with the county because of this county tile, because we had to go through a proceeding with the drainage authority.
This
those landowners weren't interested. They would not have done that on their own. Right? So we were able to help them in a number of different ways, coordinate the funding, design the project in a way that we assured landowners that they weren't being impacted, and then the county in the proceeding to be able to allow this to be done on that county tile. Yeah, they're really neat. When they're done, they work real well, too.
Thank you.
Did you
see the back page of that?
I haven't
looked, yeah.
I saw the next piece. Oh, I did see this.
This is the water coming into.
Recognize the revenues. They're going to be
into the system.
It's going to nitrate
the system. The water that's coming out of the pipe that you saw in that channel.
That's what's going on.
So dynamic.
Is that because it's soaking in?
The wetland vegetation is using some of it.
Okay.
Because you're actually putting in the water. It's a little chemical reaction. It takes the nitrates and it changes into different stuff.
And I would understand it if you could.
Peak discharges, too, in terms of the amount of water.
Fish fund the change.
Pink is basically what the discharge is coming into it.
In the same
so we get some
area.
I think this stuff is great. So.
Yeah, it's
interesting.
It's the fun stuff we get to work on, too.
We didn't have any regulatory stuff. Nothing showed. Let me ask you what I'm just going through this bill. The last bill? Where's the feedlot language? It's always in PCA on distributing grants. Did you guys take that out? Gene took that. It's not in this.
That's a good question.
Let me see what.
Oh,
Isn't that the truth?
It's all right there.
Oh, that's too bad.
She had her C8.
Okay, well, that.
Well, welcome.
Smoothly.
Hey.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
See if this happens. I mean, we're going to get this deal done by next week. I think this stretch.
Oh. I know. And I'm not either because
there's no the egg builder this week. There's an environment.
Well, Dan, is it egg?
Call the meeting of the Watershed, Wetlands, and Buffer Protection Subcommittee back to order. We are waiting for some members. I want to note we have an open forum that will start in a few minutes. I do have four of the testifiers are unable to be here in person, so they have provided written testimony that's in the members' packets. I want to go through a couple of those folks, and maybe Representative Peterson, I can read in the next 2 minutes, but Marilyn Lundberg from Lilydale, concerned citizen providing written testimony. Her testimony is in the packet. And staff, are written testimony provided to the audience as well? So there should be a packet up on the table there of written testimony. Up in northwestern Minnesota last fall. I moved to Park Rapids, but I still maintain some property up there, the family farm, and I have had experience with watershed districts for over 30 years. And when I read the OLA's report, I was quite impressed, and I agree with pretty much everything they recommend should be done. What I thought I'd do today, as being the time limitation, I picked out three topics
that I'll quickly go through and explain what my problems have been and why I feel it needs to be corrected. The first topic is, and all these topics, by the way, are something that I feel Bowser has had authority to take care of and an oversight that they should have been doing. First is annual audits for the watershed districts. There's a Minnesota statute, 103D.355, that requires watershed districts to do annual audits. We discovered in our watershed district that they had not been doing it for over 30 years and started pushing and demanding it to get done. When we inquired to Bowser about it, they told us, well, there's not much they can do because they have no oversight to make sure something like that gets done. I wanted to make sure you guys understand that there is some big serious problems there. The other thing is that these watershed districts handle state and federal money in the millions. At least ours does up there, and no audits. Where are we accounting for all this money, and how are we finding out it's being treated and done properly? On federal grants, they're supposed to do project audits. The watershed district up there has not done project audits. We have told Bowser about this, and there has been no action taking place with it. So I guess I can say that I don't think they've done a very good job of oversight there. The next thing is watershed management plans. The Minnesota statute 103D.401 requires management plans to be developed and revised and even amended as time goes on. Fact is, it says it must be done every 10 years. Our watershed district has not been doing that either. A lot of them have not been doing that in my research. When we inquired to Bowser about why that's not getting done, naturally we hear this thing, there's no money. We don't have money for it. Well, listen, the watershed districts, when they were formed, knew they had to do this every 10 years. You should have budgeted for it. I mean, if you're running a business, you don't say, well, I don't have money, I'm not going to do this or that. You budget it in. This cry about no money, give us more money, legislature, so we can do this. Hey, you should be planning for this. You should not have to be begging for that. When we had a hearing for an amendment to the watershed management plan up there, we asked for the hearing. We got the hearing. We asked that if we disagreed with the findings of the Bowser Board to approve that, if we had the rights to appeal, they said yes. We said, would we be afforded those rights? They said yes. Guess what? They went ahead and they approved it. I asked for my appeal rights. They refused to give them to me. They refused to cite them for me. They refused to give them to me, period. Where do you even find them? Their advice was that I should seek my personal legal counsel because it was so complex they didn't want to say anything. I don't think that's exactly the way things should work, that we should have to go to our private counsel to find these things out. I asked for reconsideration by the rules of that same decision and was told it was denied. No reason given for the denial. Just, hey, it's denied. So there's things that need to be corrected there. The final thing I want to talk about, and I think is probably the most important, is the distribution of managers of watershed districts. Bowser has that authority. They got the power. They're the ones that set these whole things up when they're developed. They got the right to redistribute them when it's requested. Minnesota law, I think, is very clear. 103D.301 talks about subdivision 1, more than one affected county. If more than one county is affected by a watershed district, the board must provide that the managers are distributed by residents among the counties affected by the watershed district. Well, my watershed district consists of 5 counties. We have 7 members. 3 counties have no way of appointing anybody. They've eliminated them. They told them, no, you're not going to have the right to appoint. I don't understand that. The subdivision 1 is very clear. Among the counties. It doesn't say they have to be equal. It doesn't say anything like that. But it says among the counties. To me, that means to each of. The explanation we got was, well, wait a minute, the word among is not defined in statute. So we're going to make up our own ruling saying it doesn't mean everybody gets representation. Well, if our forefathers would have looked at that and took that same approach when they were developing this country, we would have had a lot of states, a lot of counties, a lot of townships without representation because they're too small. Another point is that when they redistributed these managers or enlarged the watershed district up there a couple years ago, about 90% or more of the people in that enlargement area signed petitions that they did not want to join. They did not believe it was necessary, didn't think it would do them any good. Yet Bowser went ahead and brought that area in anyway, regardless of what the people had to say. They just overruled it. But the interesting point is they added 2 more counties at that time. It was only three, now it was five. Two of those counties are the two that don't have any representation. It's kind of like a punishment. If you're going to say you don't want to belong there, I guess you shouldn't have the right to appoint anybody either. The rationale was, oh, they're so small, the population's small, it doesn't matter. I don't believe that's the way the law was intended to be interpreted. I don't believe that's the way it should be. Watershed districts levy taxes. They spend a lot of money. People have the right to be represented, and they're being non-represented at this time. To further that, there's another subdivision, subdivision 2 of the distribution of managers, which talks about if it's more than five counties, the Bowser Board has the right to set up manager areas and select the county commissioner group that would appoint for that area. So in the wisdom of the legislature, they saw fit to say, hey, we know if it gets too large, it's going to be cumbersome. It's going to be impossible to have everybody represented, possibly. But if that's the case, you guys can do districts, appoint a commissioner group to appoint somebody. But everybody's going to be served. If it's five or less, then everybody should have at least one. If you're going to give more, that's your business, how you want to divide it up. The ones with more areas should have more representation. But everyone must have a representative. I think that's very clear with everything.
Mr. Stengram, do you have any written testimony you want to provide if we're running short here?
I can leave some of these notes that I, especially on the distribution managers, I drafted quite an extensive thing there. I guess the way I'll end this is simply just say that I've read over the old lady's report. I'm very glad they did it. It's time something is done, and I recommend that you should consider everything they put in here because I think that's what we need. The people need to know that they're going to be properly represented, and the laws are going to be followed by the people that's overseeing them. There's a good reason why it should be an appointed executive director there, so they answer to someone other than a board that wants to do their own thing. The board consists today of people that belong to all these other boards. It's kind of like a relative situation. You're not going to overrule yourself once you've already approved something down the hill and so forth with it. So I guess at that, I must be close to my 5 minutes. So,
any questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Stender. Joe Carlisle. Joe Carlisle. John Zandmiller. Mr. Zandmiller, if you could state your name and where you reside.
My name is John Zandmiller. I live in the city of West St. Paul, greatest city in Minnesota. Thank you for hearing me today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. When I was a young man, we'd play schoolyard football, and we couldn't agree if there was a penalty or not. We used to do what we called a do-over, and I think we've reached that point with Soil and Water and Bowser and watershed management organizations throughout the state. My neighbors often wonder aloud every time we have an election, what is this Soil and Water Conservation District? What do they do? In a community of 5 square miles, it's 98% developed, with a 4-acre apple orchard being the only thing close to an agricultural area. We wonder about its relevance. We also wonder about the supervisors, who they are, what they represent, what they're trying to do. We also wonder about the relationship with groups such as NRCS. You know, how does that impact an urbanized area? But what I've found in my short period of time in researching this is that there is some problems. Disproportional districts. For instance, Supervisory District 1 in Dakota County has 206,000 residents, whereas District 4 has 4,400 residents, District 5 has 3,300 districts. In my city alone, we have more people than in Districts 4 and 5 combined. The other thing I noticed, and that's from the 2003 census figures, minority population in Dakota County. The average minority population in District 1, Supervisory District 1, is about 8 times higher than District 5. Members of the committee, if this was a congressional district, we would all be sitting in district court right now trying to correct this problem. The districts are also run countywide, and it's my hypothesis that because the mission of the Soil and Water District seems to be more geared towards the agricultural portions of the county, there's far more interest in it in the southern part, the more agricultural and rural parts of the county. And we feel that, my neighbors and I feel, that it impacts the outcome of the elections, having countywide elections for each of these supervisory districts. I looked at 3 years of data on expenditures and revenue for the Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District and found that there was no clear revenue streams, that funding was disproportionate, and it seemed that these programs favored the agricultural interests. So one of the things that I've done over the last couple of years is start to pay attention to Bowser and what Bowser does. And I have to say that I was very disappointed that Bowser didn't take a more active role in working with Dakota County on this issue, because we went to Dakota County and asked them to redistrict, and they wholeheartedly denied us the opportunity to have equal representation. One voter, one vote. I also noticed that Bowser could have done far more than they did with the problems in the Badlands Lake Watershed Management Organization, which was the Powers Board. There were some serious problems with FLAMO, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources was surprisingly quiet on the whole issue. I want to make some suggestions for possible solutions. There needs to be dedicated funding. There needs to be appropriate oversight. There needs to be clear and convincing missions for these districts. And if I could throw out something, you know, periodically I try to swing for the fence. And my swing for the fence idea today is that we look at abolishing it, starting over. Yes, oversight's appropriate. Let's merge soil and water districts with watershed managements. In one of the written testimonies today I saw is referred to as a Nebraska plan. That makes sense, especially in urbanized areas. Members of the committee, my concern is that the problems that we've seen in other urban soil and water conservation districts are only going to become greater. We're going to see Mr. Mouse nearly elected in rural counties if we don't correct this problem to these boards. I think there needs to be wholesale changes, changes across the board in the management implementation. And I speak to you not only just as a member of a community that's urban. I speak to you as a rural landowner and as a sportsman. I know there are problems out here, and I do not dispute the absolute need for these organizations to exist, but they need to exist in such a manner that they get something done. I don't like the fact that I have to drive to Roseau to see ducks because they aren't in my neck of the woods like they used to, and it's directly tied to the loss of wetland. We're seeing so many things happening. We talked about aquatic and terrestrial invasive species earlier when Mr. Thomas was up here. I don't know if you folks realize this, but St. Paul's water prices are going to be affected by aquatic invasive species because a ballast tank threw zebra mussels into the Mississippi River. They're going to hit the St. Paul water intakes, which runs through a chain of lakes. So the end user of the Mississippi River is now responsible. We need Bowser to step up to the plate, not just in terms of oversight on their watershed management organizations and soil and water conservation districts, but also in terms of the work they do at the next level up the food chain, advocating for the subordinate agencies. Checks and balances are good. Adequate representation is even better. And a better America, better Minnesota, is going to be the best we can hope for.
Thank you, Mr. Zandler. Any questions? Thank you. John Waller and Francis Myron are going to go together. And if you could state your name and residence for the record.
Morning, committee chair, committee members. My name is Fran Miron. I'm a family farmer from Hugo, Minnesota. I also serve there as the mayor of the city of Hugo. I've been involved in local government since 1990. I serve as board member for the Washington Dakota Farm Service Agency. I'm a member of Farm Service Agency. I'm a member of Farm Bureau and other farm organizations. My family was named Conservationists of the Year in Washington County for the year 2000. Now, I'm not here today in any of those capacities. I'm here as an individual private owner, landowner that's been affected by drainage on my property. I own and operate a family farm that's been in the family for over a century and a quarter. My son, who is working with me on the farm, represents a fifth generation of our family that's worked on that farm. Allow Mr. Waller to identify himself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is John Waller. I'm from 1410 Homestead Avenue, Hewlett, Minnesota. I'm here representing my family farm and as a citizen. But just as a disclosure, because I got a little warning here when I was at the committee before from some of the agency memberships, I'm a member of the Rice Creek Watershed District Board of Managers. I've been appointed in January, so I've been to about two meetings or three or something like that. However, I was also a member of the Washington County Governance Study Committee, and I've been an active citizen in trying to get the Watershed District to provide the services for the taxes we pay. And we'll talk about that this morning and the effect of and what my experience has been in a almost 15-year to 20-year experiences with the Watershed District. I also served on the Watershed District Citizens Advisory Committee for the last few years, and I served on it in the late 70s and early 80s. So I have a long history with the Watershed District, and I have, for example, the preliminary draft and draft, all the plans that the Watershed District has had. We're in the third generation now. I'll turn it back to Mr. Muron.
We're here today to respond to the Legislative Auditor's Report on Watershed Management, and specifically the response to that report by the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. And I refer to this handout that was passed out to you earlier, I believe, at previous hearings. The two issues that we'd like to specifically address are that within this handout that they sent out, were the issues that watershed districts are water quality and flood control experts, and that watershed districts demonstrate accountability. There's been a renewed focus here at the legislature on wetlands and the role they serve within our ecosystem, and I think that's a healthy discussion. However, I think the role of watershed management organizations and watershed districts to protect land from flooding that we noticed a number of years ago up in the Red River Valley with the Red River, even more recently in my home county, the flooding along the St. Croix River in Stillwater and the damage it did to the downtown area there. Flood control and water quality go hand in hand. We need to be cautious not to legislate away our ability to provide flood control in favor of water quality or vice versa. The map that Mr. Waller just handed out is a map of the area, and both of our farms are included within that map. You'll see those are actually Washington County maps, and I draw to your attention the comparison between Rice Lake. Both of our properties abut Rice Lake. Rice Lake has a judicial ditch that provides an outlet for that lake. And if you look at those maps and compare the years and the dates, you'll see the expanse of Rice Lake. Onica Lake is also on that map, and you'll notice in those particular maps, Onica Lake remains relatively the same size. Onica Lake is a landlocked lake and has no outlet. So you see the major expanse. In 1984, I first raised these issues of concern with the Watershed District at a public hearing that they had. I subsequently had managers stop out at my property, take a look at the flooding we were experiencing. In 1994, 10 years later, the Watershed District published a ditch report which showed that culverts within that ditch system were out of alignment. We began to question that information that was provided in that ditch report, and the city became involved in a joint study with the Watershed District to determine the profile of judicial ditch number two. We found that the Watershed District, which was established in 1973, had been managing this ditch system, so between 1973 and 1994, without an official profile on that ditch. And I know there's some legislation out there that you're looking at now that provides some funding to update those records and provide some of that information. Now, the city and the Watershed District worked jointly to establish that profile. Subsequently, after doing that work, all of the original ditch records were located in the Washington County Courthouse. Washington County, prior to turning over their authority to the Watershed District for management of the system, was the ditch authority over judicial ditch number two. Those records confirmed the profile that we established through soil borings and some extensive and costly work that the city and the watershed district did. After that joint study to determine the profile, in 1998, that work was completed, and the city requested an obstruction hearing because there were culverts within that system that were placed 6 feet too high. Okay, to give you an idea, there's about a foot of drop per mile in that area where the ditch is, and these culverts were placed 6 feet too high, as much as 6 feet too high. Once that study was complete, we requested an obstruction hearing before the watershed district, and the watershed district denied that obstruction hearing. Subsequently, we went to court. The city was involved in that. Private landowners were involved, hired their own attorney to represent them, and we're still involved in litigation today. 1984, today is 2007. This issue still is not resolved. There's been over $2 million in public dollars that has been spent on this argument, in addition to a lot of private dollars that were spent. And I could share with you the dollars that I've spent on this system. As I said, I think flood control and water quality go hand in hand. The legislative auditor's report refers to a situation up in Comfort Lake. We're familiar with that. These drainage systems, and in many cases are natural systems, Judicial Ditch 2 became a judicial ditch, but it was a natural creek prior to that. It was dug in a straight line as opposed to the meandering creek that it was, but dug to a similar profile as what the original creek was. There was no real additional drainage provided. It just provided for more efficiency and an easier opportunity to maintain the system. This system drains a substantial area within our ecosystem. And when you flood that system, as demonstrated in the study that I referred to, there's tremendous loss of plant material, which causes phosphorus loading downstream. This ditch empties into Peltier Lake. Peltier Lake is part of the Chain of Lakes water system, which was referred to earlier by the mayor of West St. Paul. So it becomes very, very important. But phosphorus has been one of our big problems. And I'd like Mr. Waller to talk a little bit about that impact.
Mr. Waller.
Mr. Chairman. I brought a couple samples with me today. These are samples of wood. They're cut off the family farm at home. So when you folks that are in the House of Representatives go over there for your meeting and you look at that big picture of Abraham Lincoln, you can remember that this particular piece of basswood, which has been dead now for about 15 years, was alive when Mr. Lincoln was President of the United States and we were a new state. Now that's a result of, from our registered foresters' examination of our woodlands, of high waters, killed many of these basswoods. We also killed our tamarack forests here, which I don't have. I misplaced my 18-inch piece of tamarack in diameter. I couldn't find it this morning. So when that died, my father then decided that he'd plant some more tamarack a little higher up, and then they got killed when the next culvert went in, 6 feet too high, instead of the one that was just 5 feet too high. I've been involved in this for many
years now, trying to get some kind of accountability for my tax dollar that I'm paying. I noticed that your Office of Legislative Auditor on page 61 and 62 used the word accountability 6 times in talking about watershed districts. And I feel that that's a very, very important thing that has to come about. We have, when we asked to take the beaver dams out, they said we can't do that for you because we don't know how deep the ditch is. How deep's the ditch? Well, we don't have a profile. My brother and I went to the county recorder's office. They asked about the profile. They said, we don't have it. We asked the county commissioner in the hallway, begged him, would you make one phone call to the county recorder and ask her to really look thoroughly? A week later, we had the judge's decision for the judicial ditch. We had the engineer's handwritten report for the judicial ditch. We had the petitions for and against the judicial ditch. We had the survey for the ditch. We even had how much
had been taken out by every 100 feet, every yard, and paid for. So we had all of these records that were down there for years, and this was like 25 years after the watershed district's been formed. We're involved in this. We're not getting this our drainage. I'm paying a tax every year, and I'm not receiving that particular drainage that I want. So I ask you very much today to start taking a look at about our pre-existing drainage property right that pre-exists the Public Waters Act of 1937, that pre-exists the Wetland Conservation Act of 1992, that pre-exists the Watershed District Act of 1955, that pre-exists the Department of Conservation of 1925, which used to be known as the Department of Drainage before they changed the name. And our pre-existing rights need to be respected, and I don't see that happening in the present system, and I don't see any accountability for that. And I pay that tax every year. I expect to get that service.
Thank you. When this system became somewhat functional after the watershed district did some repair to the system, we saw wild rice growing in that lake bed area. We saw ducks come back. My family hunts. We're active hunters. I allow other people to come onto our property and hunt. We saw more ducks during that period of time than we did in the previous 20 years that the DNR had been managing that area. We suggest that, you know, in many cases, particularly where we're dealing with natural drainage systems that existed prior to some of the ditch law and things that came into place, that those systems do serve an important function here in providing for wildlife habitat and water quality. John and I come here today as landowners that really have attempted, and our parents have attempted, to be good stewards of that property over the years. You don't span a period of five generations on a farm without being good stewards. And I come before you today suggesting that we are good stewards, we are conservation-minded, and there needs to be some changes here. There needs to be some accountability. There needs to be some protection from flooding in these areas. And we don't need to spend millions of public dollars to do it.
Mr. Chairman, I have...
You just be mindful of the
one,
time.
One last question. I've been mindful of time, sir. And I ask each committee member this. $37,000 has been spent of public money to put an obstruction in a public ditch in a natural water course. Not the DNR, not the Watershed District, not the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. No public agency or entity wants to take credit for that structure that has been built on private property without any easement. Where's the accountability to these organizations? Thank you very much, committee members and Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Any questions from members?
I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Barb Lang and Joe Lang are unable to make it, and their testimony is written and provided in members' packets and is available for the audience. Previously, it noted that Marilyn Lundberg was unable to make it, and her testimony is provided written in the packets and for the audience. I've just received a note that Tom Landwehr with the Nature Conservancy is over in the Senate in a hearing and is probably not going to be able to make it. So I would move to check if Joe Carlisle had arrived. Joe Carlisle. Move to Eric Evenson, who is the district manager for the Minnehaha Watershed District.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
I think this committee should be rather hard on Tom Landwehr when we do see him, being at the Senate instead of the House.
Mr. Evenson.
Good morning. I'm Eric Evenson. I reside in Carver, Minnesota. I've been the district administrator for the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District for over 8 years now. Prior to that, I was a senior planner for Dakota County for about 10 years. And prior to, I've been working in natural resources and water management in Dakota County. And prior to that, I worked for an organization out of the Red River Basin and put together some of the first water management, comprehensive county-based water management plans in the state. I've got well over 20 years' experience in water management. Pam Blix, a board manager, was unable to be here today. Pam's got about 15 years of experience, but wasn't able to attend. Over the past several years, the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District has been involved in a number of relatively controversial issues. And it's interesting, in both cases, we've been vilified and deified over this very same issues several times. I wanted to touch just on the audit report. Audits make me uncomfortable, no question about that, but I don't fear them. I actually approached the state auditor when they were starting this report and asked that we be a case study, not for any other reason than I wanted to know, based on our history, if we were doing a good job or if there were opportunities or chances that we needed to have some improvements. While I think, in general, the audit gave us a relatively positive review, I'd be silly to think that there's not plenty of more room for improvement within our organization. We're always striving to look to improve. I think the old adage is, if you think you got all the answers, you're not asking the right questions is very true. And I think the audit and the state currently are asking the right questions on water management. I think there are opportunities for improvement in water management. So we've been dancing around the fringe of this issue for many years. I was here before the Environment Committee almost 10, 12 years ago talking about the concerns that at the time the county had that the WMO structures weren't working. We're spending thousands of dollars, now hundreds of thousands of dollars, on plans that were never being implemented. We were invited here today to share some thoughts on water management. We've handed out some drafts of some ideas floating around. These are just very rough drafts at this point in time. But they really capture some of the issues that seem to be gaining a little bit of attention down here, and that is the basin-wide approach to water management. The watershed district is supportive of a basin-wide approach to a statewide basin that is across the entire state dealing with watershed management. One of the things that we looked at this as we were coming up with these ideas is, I don't think just money is the answer to solving the problem with water management in the state. I think there's a need for additional resources. Don't get me wrong. I think there's a very strong need for additional resources. But I think the additional resources have to come along with some sort of restructuring on how water is managed in the state. On the basin-wide issue, we're here to encourage you to continue to explore this and want to throw out a few ideas. We feel that a basin-wide approach to water management makes a number of sense in a number of ways, in that it could build on the existing infrastructures that are already out there. It can allow the flexibility in how water is managed on a local level. We don't have watershed districts across the state. However, we can establish these basins across the state, and within each of those basins, there are a number of unique combinations of entities that manage water that can continue to manage on as they have on the local level, but need to kind of look at things on a more coordinated approach on a basin-wide a level. The OLA reports highlights the diversity amongst water management entities throughout the state. It indicates that there is not one structure that seems to work better than another. Since local individuals are more likely to be knowledgeable of local resources, local issues, and policies than agency staff, what we're recommending is that much of the focus and oversight be shifted not totally away from a strong central office, but much more into regional basins across the state of Minnesota. We feel that this approach could reduce the dependence of local water management on state funding over the long term. I think that it would reduce the need to grow a large central staff. There certainly needs to grow regional staff across the state. And rather than a state organization trying to monitor, I think I heard 341 local units of government that are involved in water management across the state of Minnesota, you'd have a central office really looking more at seven or eight larger organizations. We feel that a basin-wide approach could provide the leadership, the oversight, the mentoring needed to assist water management across the state. We would expect that these basin-wide organizations would be there to establish some general goals for each basin. I mean, the approach is already exists in the state. You've got the Red River Basin. You've got a number of other basins in the state that we would see you building upon. We would see these organizations also be responsible for the review of annual reports, review of problem watershed organizations, water management organizations within the basin. We see these organizations working on mediation and guidance to organizations that may be faltering or may have issues that need resolving. We also see and would recommend along with this that we don't necessarily bring agency staff in to work directly with some of the failing organizations. What we're encouraging you to take a look at is to create kind of a peer review panel, if you would, to deal with these problems. I can tell you just from my personal experience working up in the Red River Valley that you send a young state agency person up to put the hammer down on some of these organizations up there. It's a tough job for the person to do it. So what we're encouraging is when you see you have a non-functioning or problematic organization to, again, using this basin-wide approach, to pull a panel of experts from within the basin, a panel of whether the administrators or board members or a combination of people, to actually work with the failing organization to help mentor them, to bring them back into a place where they are functioning at a higher level. I think you're using the similar model as the TEP panels, for example, where you bring in individuals from various groups to work with these people. It would also save the state some money in that you wouldn't have to have a paid state staff up there working with them. You'd be working on a local level. And again, I think mentoring by peers is always more beneficial than coming in as a so-called expert into some of these parts of the state. I certainly don't think that any one person really could have a full appreciation of especially somebody who might not be familiar with Northeast Minnesota, Northwest Minnesota, or any other part of the state, have a full appreciation for the issues that they deal with up there. So with that, I just wanted to wind it up. I think that looking at basin-wide approach across Minnesota makes a lot of sense. I think you can build on some of the very successful aspects of water management in the state, the uniqueness of the structures that exist out there, but within a coordinated framework that can provide the level of accountability that the state is asking for, that the OLA highlighted. I think it actually strengthens the role of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. At the same time, puts more of the responsibility and strengthens this whole idea of citizen ownership over the resources and the management of these resources. I think that it's not necessarily building a new level of government. This exists out there. The state manages the resources largely by basin boards through the DNR and the PCA. There's quite a number of regional offices that Bowser has out there, too, that you could build upon. So you'd be literally building upon an existing structure. And I think it would be an easier pill for a lot of folks to swallow. I mean, people are very afraid of change. When you start talking about major changes, people get nervous about that. This is simply saying that, look, we can provide, you can keep working within the structures that you're comfortable with, but we want to provide a overarching oversight. We're actually calling these basin boards, we're calling them basin citizen oversight boards to really highlight the fact that this is a citizen base and that's their job. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Pamela Blixt is not coming.
That's correct.
She's provided some written testimony. John Chell with the Arrowhead Regional Development.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is John Chell. I'm with the Arrowhead Regional Executive Commission, and I serve as Executive Director. Over the last 2 years, over 30 organizations in the northern part of the state, including state agencies and elected officials at the county level, have been working to find ways to work within the current wetland laws in order to provide a more efficient approach to regulatory and mitigation within regulations and mitigation within our wetland laws in the state. We've now completed that report, again, 30 organizations, public and private. And with me today to acquaint you, I believe in your packets is a handout for a summary of some of the points this 2 years of work has made. Our Len Kramer, who is a senior vice president of bar engineering here in the cities, and Tom Tree, who's environmental manager for St. Louis County. Also with us today is Dennis Fink, who is a county commissioner with St. Louis County. But Tom and Len will present this information.
Chairman, my name is Len Kramer. As John indicated, I'm with a local consulting engineering company, and we do a lot of work up in northeast Minnesota for both local governments and for industry. So both Tom and I and John served on this committee that he described. There's a serious problem up in northeast Minnesota to accommodate the economic development that's occurring up there. I'm sure you're all aware that there is a lot of economic development occurring, and that economic development consists of commercial residential areas, public roads, and MnDOT highways, and industrial development, including mining. The commercial and residential development that is occurring needs about 100 acres a year of wetland mitigation over the next 5 years. The public road program needs 130 to 150 acres of wetland mitigation over the next 5 years. Industrial development, including mining, needs about 300 acres a year over the next 5 years. So you add that all up, that's almost 3,000 acres in the next 5 years of wetland mitigation that's needed. The problem is that these counties that were involved in this development of this wetland mitigation strategy have over 80% of their pre-development wetlands, and they account for about 82% of the total wetlands that are available in the state of Minnesota. So it's very difficult to find wetland mitigation opportunities. And in accordance with the current rules, the first thing that you're supposed to do in developing mitigation is to try to locate that mitigation within the watershed and within the bank service area, and that's very, very difficult to do up there. So this committee met for 18 months and came out with several recommendations, and four of those recommendations are summarized in the handout that was included in your materials. There are a couple of other recommendations also as part of that. The most important two of those four recommendations is the second one that's listed, the development of a Northeast Wetland Mitigation Inventory, and the third one, which is to conduct a regional mitigation siting analysis. And the focus of those would be, first of all, to inventory any opportunities that are left. Most of the committee members realize that there are not very many opportunities available up in that area. And then to the second one would be to analyze the opportunities that are available, and then to identify the needs outside the bank service area. The result of that, I think all of the committee members feel, is that we would find that there is a need to mitigate outside the bank service area. That has been a focus of a lot of the wetland permitting that has gone on so far. A lot of that permitting is permitting activities are pointed towards development of mitigation opportunities outside the bank service area. The third most important was to develop mitigation guidelines. One of the things that's happening now is that it's not clear how much mitigation credit you're going to get for the various activities that you undertake. And so the individuals that go through this permitting process are kind of up in the air as to what kind of credits they're going to get. And it's, the process is very long and very complicated. And so if these three activities are undertaken and completed, it'll make this process for all of the entities that have to go through it a lot simpler. And again, it'll point to the need to mitigate outside the banking service area. The fourth item that's mentioned there is to develop a mitigation bank. Not as high a priority as the others, but a fairly high priority. And there's a variety of ways that have been talked about by the committee in order to do that. One is to set up a bank that's similar to the Bowser Road Bank. The other would be to create incentives for private bankers to actually provide a larger bank of Wetland Banking. Currently, if you look at that, the 18 counties, there are only 65 acres available in the private banks, and you have a need over the next 5 years of 3,000 acres. So if those incentives could be created, we think that the private banking industry may step up. So some of those mitigation needs are immediate. There are projects that are looking at needing 500 to 700 acres in the next few years. So it's a very urgent need. Then the last two recommendations were to update the national wetland inventory up in that area and to identify research needs for wetland mitigation types and things like that. They're not as pressing, but they are also needed. With that, I think that I've explained at least what's in the summary that you have and what the activities of the committee were, Tom.
Excuse me. My name is Tom Tree. I'm the Environmental Project Manager for St. Louis County, and I just want to add a couple of things. I have nearly 30 years' experience with St. Louis County trying to find wetland mitigation for road projects, and I've been through various changes to WACA ever since its inception. So I know the difficulties trying to find wetlands when you have 45% of your geographic area that's taken up by lakes or wetlands. And much of our area, Mr. Chairman, is in public ownership, which doesn't lend itself to traditional wetland mitigation opportunities because it hasn't been effectively drained like other parts of the state has. So, and the other thing that I wanted to add was the Corps of Engineers and the EPA is asking us to look for opportunities in our own backyard before going to other parts of the state, and to actually demonstrate that we have no opportunities before we go to other watersheds, or else we would be assigned a penalty for replacing wetland impacts out of watershed at a 25% cost. So I guess what we are hoping to present with you and leave with you is that we need some help in trying to find wetland mitigation. I understand that funds are very tight this year, and the legislature has its priorities. This process did not get in Bowser's budget because it came on after their budget was already set for this year, so you did not hear the recommendations come up in your presentation this morning. Estimated cost is $500,000 to $750,000 for those three recommendations, and we would appreciate any consideration you might be able to give us. One thing I would like to add is that Bowser Board has accepted the recommendations of the report. It's been involved from the start on this process, and John Jasky has said that they would implement that if they received the appropriate funding.
Okay. Any questions? You may want to be around on Tuesday, because I think in Representative Eakin's committee there's going to be a number of wetland bills being heard then. So we might have a little more time there to go over that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Mr. Landwehr, I walked in.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tom Landwehr, I'm the Assistant State Director of the Nature Conservancy, and I heard when I heard the hearing was coming on here, I dashed over from the Senate. I want members to understand that this is the important body to be at, and I left several long faces in the Capitol, and pleased to be here today. Thank you for the opportunity. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here today to talk about the Wetland Reserve Program proposal and the governor's recently announced amended budget for $10 million for WRP. It's a program that Nature Conservancy strongly supports. I'll tell you, I work with wetlands and grasslands day in and day out, and I am more confused today about the future of natural resources in rural Minnesota than I have ever been. We've got corn pushing $4 a bushel. We've got demand for biofuels. We have no idea what that's going to mean either in terms of diverse grasslands or corn and beans. We have a farm bill that's completely up for grabs with less dollars available, it appears, than in the past. And our current conservation reserve program is even being challenged right now with opportunities perhaps for landowners to opt out early and the potential for there to be no re-enrollments. I think the future in rural Minnesota is pretty unclear right now. I think we have an opportunity here to seize, to secure some long-term habitat that gives us a little bit of clarity on natural resources in rural Minnesota. The Wetland Reserve Program, as you know, is a perpetual program. It provides landowners the incentive via both an easement and practice payments to restore wetlands, restore grasslands on their property, and leave them in perpetuity. I think the opportunity we have right now is to secure some leverage. We can receive a dollar to a dollar and a half of federal money for each dollar of state money that we provide into the current proposal. We will have some focus in working with the Board of Water and Soil Resources to make sure those restorations are directed into areas where they provide the most benefit for both wildlife and water quality. They help address the impaired waters situation in the state of Minnesota, because every time you restore a wetland, you close a ditch, you're keeping water on the ground where it belongs rather than in the Minnesota River, where it will ultimately end up via tile lines and ditches. And I think the important message I'd use is it's perpetual. We have about 2 million acres of CRP in Minnesota today. We could have zero in 8 years. We have no idea what the future of CRP is in Minnesota, but it is clear that it is not going to be what it has been in the past. I think if you looked at southeast Minnesota in 1986, there was a whole bunch of CRP that was available in 1986 in the southeastern Minnesota counties, and there were pheasants all over the place. Shortly, 10 years later, when the payment structure changed for CRP, there is no CRP anymore in the southeast, and we have terrible water quality problems in many of our premier trout fisheries as a result in part of that. And it's just evident, the type of evidence that just hits you in the face, that CRP should not be looking at a long-term solution. It's a short-term solution. We're facing some uncertain times. So I encourage you today to support the Wetland Reserve Program proposal that the Board of Water and Soil Resources is carrying, that the governor is supporting, and hope you will support that when the time comes to provide some funding. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm a fan of wetlands, and I'm a fan of preserving them, and I'm a fan of perpetual easements. And I've also seen how that can go terribly awry if you don't have a mechanism and a desire within our public agencies to make sure that these wetlands don't succumb to something else. And you know what I'm referring to, and that's the wetlands that folks bought with their federal duck stamp money, and they had wonderful wetlands in perpetuity. And now we use them to raise fish, and those wetlands are in sad shape. And if you don't have two things, it's not going to work. One is a good way to oversee and check on your wetlands, and a desire on the part of the agency to do just that. How is that built in to this?
The Wetlands Reserve Program. Representative Wajinius, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. It's a great question. I think, you know, as you know, we've talked at length about the issue with monitoring easements and the specific language in easements. One of the provisions of Wetland Reserve Program, which was really the federal government's first foray into conservation easements, and I think they've done a very credible job and have improved over time. One of the provisions is that there's no, commercial uses are not allowed on a Wetland Reserve Program easement. That's not something that is prohibited on the type of Fish and Wildlife Service duck stamp easement that you're talking about. Those easements do allow commercial uses, and Wetland Reserve Program does not. So, for instance, if I have a Wetland Reserve Program parcel, if I own a piece of land and I own the underlying fee of that, I cannot open a pheasant preserve for commercial uses. I cannot raise fish via aquaculture license on there. I can't make money off of that property other than, you know, the $10 somebody might give me to hunt on my property just in casual recreation. So some of that is protected. So I think the answer to your question is that in some ways the law, the provisions, the easements are written tighter for Wetland Reserve Program than they are for the drain, burn, fill easements that the Fish and Wildlife Service took under the duck stamp program. Secondarily, I'd offer that the WRP program, especially when it's in conjunction with Bowser, which makes it the WREP, Wetland Reserve Enhancement Program, is implemented via local offices. So you have the local Soil and Water Conservation District office, which Representative Hansen understands well, watching these easements, monitoring these easements, because the state of Minnesota actually owns the easement in this case, even though the Natural Resource Conservation Service helped pay for it. The state owns it. It's administered via the local SWCD. And the SWCDs, you know, if you are a technician in the Soil and Water Conservation District, you know every acre of land in the county. I mean, those folks, they have driven those roads, and they watch. So you have eyes out there on a daily basis, is my point. And they understand what can be and what cannot be allowed on those easements, and that's not something that you have typically available via the Fish and Wildlife Service drain, burn, fill easements. You've got, in those cases, you've got wetland management district offices, which cover several counties with a handful of people, and they just don't have the ability to monitor. So I think you've got better language and you've got better monitoring. Having said that, the easements are still relatively new. The Wetland Reserve Program was created in 1990. We don't have a long history, and usually the problems don't pop up in the first 10 years. They pop up in year 20 and 30 and 40. And so I think we will still learn more about them, but I do think we're off to a better start.
Good that we're off to a better start, but I still have worries because nobody ever expected when the first easements, the federal easements, were written, that people would use them for commercial purposes. They were written with goodwill, and I didn't see. They were written with goodwill, and they were accepted with goodwill. But we have a DNR that our own agency is closing their eyes to those. So that is a problem where we, the state, we're supposed to be protecting, are not doing it. I don't know how we change that culture. Part of it is our own culture. And so I'm worried about these easements because there are always ways. Easements cannot be written locked tight. I wish they could be, but we've seen that that doesn't work. So, and I'm sure they're getting better. But better isn't best. So I still worry and wonder how we are going to make sure that these are protected in perpetuity as they're supposed to be. And I'm not confident yet that we've achieved that. Do you share that skepticism?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I think the challenge that you pose two challenges there, really. One is to ensure that we have the agency willingness, authority to do the right thing, and I think that is something that you collectively can address via statute, and I think probably does need to be addressed. The second is whether or not we can anticipate future issues that might arise on easements, and I think, you know, to some extent, sure we can. We can address the issues that we know are out there right now. You know, invasive species, for instance, we can address invasive species, but as you mentioned, 30 years ago, nobody was thinking about raising walleyes in Candy, Ohio County. And now it's, you know, the state for crying out loud, licenses 40,000 acres of wetlands for aquaculture. So I think as issues change, as issues arise, we may or may not have the ability within an easement that we write today to anticipate that. I think one of the changes that we've seen in the development of easements is that it used to be that easements simply prohibited certain activities, and I think the sophistication of easements today is such that we allow certain activities. Everything else is prohibited with the exception of these things that are listed. So the tool has grown. Is it going to be perfect? You know, hindsight's always better, and 10 years from now we'll look back at the ones we write today and say, geez, we should include this in future easements too.
We will be hearing House File 1786 in the Capital Investment Committee a week from today, and that, I think the governor's budget proposal will be a vehicle for that. So maybe between now and then there can be some work on that. We'll probe this a little bit more. I do want to give the opportunity, because I know we had someone who is Joe Carlisle here. Is there, if there's anyone else who could want to speak, I want to give them the opportunity.
All right. Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else here who would like to speak in the open microphone? Okay, we will just the schedule for the next week. We will be meeting twice next week, following up on the budget and bills that will be coming. We have on Tuesday three bills that we'll be considering. We'll be meeting at 12:30 in 500 South. Then the following that Friday, we'll be hoping to have the Bowser budget completed and passed on to Representative Wagenius's committee a week from the end of this today. So we have a bit of work ahead of us. Thank you for coming today, and the meeting is adjourned.